The first part of the class, as I said, what I'm going to do here, and I'm a little bit concerned today because some of you may know what the Evangelical Theological Society is. Some of you have probably never heard of it. The Evangelical Theological Society was founded in 1949 and as an association of evangelical Christians. And without getting too much into the definition of evangelical, this is the Bible believers, okay? Distinguished from fundamentalist only culturally, okay? Where fundamentalists generally would want to withdraw generally from the major universities because we don't want to go out and be with the people who are unbelievers. The evangelicals, while we'd all, along with fundamentalists, while we would hold the same doctrines of inerrancy, the deity of Christ, and the penal substitution view, the atonement, all these kinds of things, the evangelicals want to engage culture and society, and generally the fundamentalists withdraw from society. And that's one of the things that defines the difference between an evangelical and a fundamentalist. So, Evangelical Theological Society was formed in 1949 in opposition to much of the liberal scholarship that was going on and against the non-interventionist, you know, withdrawal theories of the fundamentalists. Well, at that time, there was only one doctrinal tenet, and that was the doctrine of inerrancy. And 20, 30 years later, when a modalistic monarchian wanted to join, so you remember that from our Trinitarian series, modalists wanted to join from the United Pentecostal Church, they added one more tenet to the doctrinal statement, the doctrine of the Trinity. And that's all there is for the Evangelical Theological Society. It's supposed to be a broad evangelical ecumenical organization that people who would believe the essentials of the Protestant Christian faith could come and dialogue about scholarly issues. So I mentioned so every year there is an annual meeting where people present papers, scholarly papers in respective fields. It ranges everywhere from philosophical issues to, you know, what is eliminative materialism to the latest in biblical archaeology, like the ossuary of James and whether or not it contained, certain things mentioning Jesus. On the side, whether there's a chiastic structure in the book of Ruth and biblical studies kinds of papers. So that the papers run the range of every possible thing you could think of that would touch the faith. But there's been a problem in that the last several years, unfortunately, what an evangelical is has been questioned. And we have a number of people in the society that hold to views such as postmodernism, and the most radical forms, which means there simply is no objective, knowable truth. There are only subjective beliefs because everybody has their own worldview glasses on, and that means you can't get to an objective worldview. As a result, there have been, of course, the last 10 years at ETS has been just, you know, deluged with papers pro and against this postmodernism kind of thing. The other thing that started about 10 years ago, which we'll talk a little bit about today, as we get there, is a view called open theism, which I mentioned a couple of weeks ago. Open theism is simply a view that says God does not know the future. Okay? God does not have, in the proper sense, classically we think of as omniscience, because of a certain view of freedom, what is called libertarian freedom, where you always have the freedom to choose otherwise, as they argue, otherwise you're not truly free. And if you have that kind of freedom wherein lies what are called the counterfactuals of freedom, in every possible situation in which you can find yourself making a choice, you always have the ability to choose otherwise or you're not free. And the argument by the open theist is, if humans have that kind of freedom, and they do, God simply cannot know what we will choose in any given moment, if it can be otherwise. He can know when we choose. He can know what we choose when we actually choose it, but he can't know what are called future contingencies. In other words, my choice is not necessary. It's contingent. It's non-necessary because it's the choice is actualized only because I freely make it happen. So it's not necessary. So in that sense, we say, therefore, God can't know the future. Now, what does that do to our doctrine of God and all kinds of other things? You have God really that is reduced to a super angel, as he's just a limited being who doesn't know and can't control the future. But what especially what this relates to is everything in the divine decree. We say that God has decreed that X should come to pass. What does that mean? It means God has, according to the Open Theist, highly probabilistic kinds of knowledge. He doesn't have certainty about events. Now, he only has certainty about whether or not he can part the Red Sea and things like that, that don't rest on human free choice. But what he does is he can make highly probabilistic guesses. And a couple of folks at ETF have said in their writings that God was mistaken about prophecy. And because we only have, you know, we have a hammer and a chisel, you know, you got to find a nail if you're going to deal with it. So we can't kick people out or restrain membership based on anything else except inerrancy of the Trinity. So we have to wait for them to say God was mistaken in a prophecy. Well, wait a minute. You know, last time we checked, Deuteronomy 18, 20 through 22 says the test for a prophet means they have to be right 100% of the time. And if not, you take them out and stone them. So does that mean we take God out and stone him to death now because he was wrong about a prophecy? I mean, this is just absurd given the criteria of the scriptures themselves. But in these writings, Clark Pinnock and Dr. Sanders, two in particular, have written and have made essentially those statements. So after 2 years of wrangling about this, about charging them with violating the doctrinal statement, there was a vote that was taken, and the vote failed to oust the two people. And there are a lot of good reasons why it didn't happen, but there are a lot of good reasons why it should have happened. And part of it is just that I don't think it never defines what's meant by inerrancy, because if you ask them, they say, well, we don't deny inerrancy. We say God inerrantly made the highest probabilistic prediction that he could as when he made it. Therefore, it wasn't an error. So those are generally the ideas. But the point is this, is that this, again, in the history of the church, we see a national group, a national organization of people who are founded primarily to defend, teach, and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. We've been descending into Gomorrah over the last 20 years by allowing this kind of stuff in. And we seem to have too many people with too much of a latitudinarian attitude towards doctrine, and they are, in fact, running the society. I can say this, Norm Geisler, you've heard of him, he resigned from the society in protest after the vote when they weren't kicked out. So there's there are some things going on that you will hear about in the near future. I'll talk a little bit about this today when we get to false views of the eternal plan of redemption. So at this conference, there's an update of what's going on in evangelicalism. We need to pray for evangelical scholars because, and this is something about academia, which I know a lot of you have gone to college, and most of you go through an academic class, you say, what is the point? Now, and that's exactly, a lot of academia is just that. If it's not Christ-centered, if it doesn't actually do something to increase faith, hope, love, and the betterment of humanity, you have to ask, what was the point? We're not supposed to go through, as the Bible says, always learning, never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. We're not supposed to get like the people at the Areopagus, whom Paul preached to, where all they did was sit around and think about interesting questions all day and debate them, never coming to a resolution and never coming to an act of fulfilling what God wants us to do in our lives. So unfortunately, academia has a tendency to do that, and that's why Christian academics need to remember that we are here to focus on fulfilling Christ's great commission. And if we do anything but help the body of Christ do that, I think we're in sin. Because we're here to preach the gospel and to fulfill that calling and to do it at the level that we're called to do. So anyway, as that with a warning, unfortunately, you know, ETF is spiraling down a little bit, and whether or not there's going to be I'm pretty sure Norman Geisler are probably trying, this is my prediction, but I'm not saying thus saith the Lord in front of it, so you won't have rocks after it if it doesn't come to pass. I think Norman Geisler will probably try and form a new evangelical theological society. But my views on that are a little bit more radical. I don't think the people who started the movement with their ideas should be the one to leave. I think we just need to get some guts and go in and force the people out who are taking it over. what is called irenicism, being nice to other people, unfortunately, is in the history of the church, always seems to take the forefront. We're so nice to people that we never want to offend them by saying their doctrine's wrong, and we have to exclude them from the community here. And that is, and just look at the history of the church. Look, I know a lot of you right now, amazingly enough, you think, you know, Harvard University was founded by evangelical Protestant believers, originally as a seminary. Now, when it fell to the Unitarians, we started Yale. When it fell to the Unitarians, we went and started Princeton. And then one by one, almost every evangelical denomination, every evangelical institution that gets started, what happens? Everybody, usually because of scholarly irenicism, we don't want to exclude people with new ideas who are pressing the boundaries. And eventually they get in, they get control of the organization, and they kick out the rest of the people with the ideas who started it. Okay? And then what we have to do? You have to pass around the hat again. We have to start a new organization, build new buildings, start new trust funds, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I advocate a new method. Fight back. Let's not put up with it, and let's take care of business. So with that, I want to give you the paper I gave them, because I think this is an important issue that Christians thought a lot about in the past 2,000 years, but American evangelicalism, I think, has dropped the ball, and that is the integration of a theology of church and state. You know, we simply have accepted the dictates or the sayings of a U.S. Supreme Court since 1947, and somehow we think separation of church and state must be in the Bible somewhere, or maybe it's in the Book of Adverbs or something like that, but I've never seen it there. You think about these ideas of church and state, and you find out that I think you can make the case that John Calvin is probably the founder of America, Thomas Jefferson, because if you look at the beginnings of this country, about 70 to 75% of those would adhere to some kind of Calvinist or Reformed theology at that time. The numbers were almost that high. Now that's branched out from Episcopalianism to Reformed to Presbyterianism. Those all stem from John Calvin. If you look at the United States form of government, it mirrors almost exactly what John Calvin wrote in his Institutes on the relationship between the civil government and the church, because that's the way they set it up in the townships. And fortunately, some natural law philosophers, Locke, Montesquieu, and others, actually agreed with that kind of theory of government. So everybody was in agreement at that time. Now, you could have a natural law theory and a scriptural theory that would give us the right kind of relationship between church and state. With that, the problem is that what we started 230 years ago, approximately, isn't going well. What we see is a decline of religious liberty. And I'll start by looking at the paper here. The abstract here is this. The church in America presently possesses less freedom than enjoyed when the country was founded. State governments historically permitted and encouraged such activities as school prayer and the teaching of creation in the public schools until, to their surprise, they were informed by the federal courts in the late 20th century that these practices were, quote, unconstitutional, close quote. This reduction of freedom was the result of an active federal justiciarchy, as I call it, usurping the legal prerogatives of the states to make their own decisions regarding, among other things, the relationship between church and state. This is primarily accomplished by applying the juridical theory of selective incorporation of the Bill of Rights. Through this practice, the United States Supreme Court simply snatched from the states their constitutional right to decide how high the metaphorical wall of separation should be built. The practical result of selective incorporation is the progressive legal exclusion of theology from public life. Thus, this paper will examine the doctrine of selective incorporation, trace its detrimental effects on religious liberty, and proffer a strategy to remedy the harms caused by it. Now, as I proceed with this, I want to just recall some things, some basic civics here. Usually when you say the word Constitution, everybody's mind immediately goes to the U.S. Constitution. In other words, a federal constitution. But as soon as you talk about constitutional law, you have to try and think about there are actually 51 constitutions with which we have to be concerned. 50 state constitutions and one federal constitution. And this is usually what's missing in a discussion, is the constitution of the state versus the constitution of the federal government and the relationship between them. And this is what this paper is going to examine. We look at an introduction here. We'll say last week, this is November 13th, Americans saw a soldier metaphorically slain in the war for religious liberty. Chief Justice Roy Moore, the Alabama Supreme Court, was removed from his office in the middle of his six-year term for allegedly violating the Alabama canons of judicial ethics. What was the damning deed of this renegade state jurist? He refused a federal court order to remove a washing machine-sized granite monument that displayed, among other things, the Ten Commandments in the rotunda of the Alabama Supreme Court building. In November 2002, U.S. District Court Judge Myron Thompson ruled the monument violated the First Amendment Establishment Clause, which states, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, close quote. Judge Thompson opined that the monument was nothing less than, quote, an obtrusive year-round religious display, close quote. Justice Moore appealed. The 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the district court. Moore then submitted a petition for a writ of certiorari to the United States Supreme Court. Cert denied. The 11th Circuit decision stands. Justice Moore claims the Alabama Constitution requires him to acknowledge God in taking the oath of office. When refusing to remove the monument, he stated, "The point is, it's not about violation of an order. It's about violation of my oath of office." He elaborated that, "And my oath of office to the Constitution requires an acknowledgement of God." He says, it's that simple. The preamble of the Alabama Constitution of 1901 reads, quote, "We, the people of the state of Alabama, in order to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invoking the favor and guidance of Almighty God, do ordain and establish the following constitution and form of government for the state of Alabama," close quote. When the Alabama Court of the Judiciary voted 9-0 to remove Chief Justice Moore from the bench, they opined that Chief Justice Moore, quote, "not only willfully and publicly defied the orders of the United States District Court, but upon direct questioning by the court, he also gave the court no assurances that he would follow that order or any similar order in the future," close quote. In short, whether the panel agreed or disagreed with Justice Moore's goal of restoring the public acknowledgement of God as a source of human law, it believed Justice Moore failed to obey a lawful order of a lawful federal judge. The question here is this: is Justice Moore a seditious, antinomian, right-wing religious wacko, right, or an incredibly principled, brave revolutionary battling against the tyranny of a growing federal justiciarchy? I believe that history, the law, and the facts in this case will reveal that Justice Moore is the latter. He is one of the few who has taken a firm stand to uphold the original intent of both the United States Constitution and the Alabama State Constitution, attempting to restore the true balance of power between the federal government and the state governments. One should never take the issue of civil disobedience lightly, and this is something we have to be concerned with here. God established human government, Genesis 9:6 and Romans 13, 1-7. And individuals have a general duty to obey the governing authorities unless there is a biblical exception that applies, for example, Daniel 6. Here we have a different kind of case, though. Roy Moore is not merely a citizen of the state of Alabama. He is the popularly elected Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, the head of one of the three branches of the Alabama state government. Thus, the fight for the Ten Commandments was a war between the constitutional exegesis of a state judge versus the constitutional exegesis of a federal judge. And the question here is, who prevails? Because this isn't a mere citizen saying, I'm not going to obey the law. This is the chief judge, justice of the state in which they reside. So we're having a war of constitutional exegesis. Now here, according to the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution, when a state law conflicts with a federal law, the federal law is supreme. Thus, if the federal constitution empowers the federal judiciary to decide a question for the states, and the normative constitutional hermeneutic is not specified, and the court has spoken, it is the supreme law of the land. Thus, if the federal government has been given the right to decide questions of religion for the states, Roy Moore is probably wrong, legally speaking, to disobey the court order. If the federal judiciary has never been given the power to decide the question, then it is a usurper of the jurisdiction of the states to decide, and Justice Moore is right to disobey. Thus, the specific legal issue to resolve is whether the federal judiciary has unlawfully usurped the authority of the states by selectively incorporating the various provisions of the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution, particularly the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses of the First Amendment, by unauthorized judicial fiat, resulting in the unlawful limitation of the freedom of religion in the several states. My answer to this is a resounding yes. Religious freedom was one of the foundational principles of the American Republic. Christians had been, among other things, displaying crosses and the Ten Commandments, giving public aid to Christian schools, teaching the Bible in the public school for over two centuries, until the justiciarchy declared these things unconstitutional. It's a curious neologism that the alleged wall of separation was built to keep Christian ideas out of public life rather than keeping the government out of the church. The most ironic part of Roy Moore's saga is that the Ten Commandments are permanently and prominently displayed in the United States Supreme Court building itself. This was noted in the 1984 case, Lynch v. Donnelly, where the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Warren Burger, noted that, quote, "The very chamber in which oral arguments on this case were being heard is decorated with a notable and permanent, not seasonal, symbol of religion, Moses and the Ten Commandments," close quote. In Lynch, the case involved a municipality displaying, among other things, a nativity scene during Christmas. Here, the Supremes held the nativity scene did not violate the Establishment Clause because it satisfied all the prongs of the Lemon v. Kurtzman test. Lemon says a law will pass muster related to Establishment Clause jurisprudence if and only if all the elements are satisfied. They are: 1. It has a secular legislative purpose. 2. Its principal or primary effect must neither advance nor inhibit religion. And 3. It must not foster an excessive government entanglement with religion, close quote. My opinion is this is clearly a Lemon law, because to talk about having religion with no religious purpose to it, it's absurd. We have to have a law concerning religion with no religious purpose to it. So the law itself is just, it's a judicial invention, the Lemon test. Ironically, 4 years prior to Lynch, the Supreme Court held in Stone v. Graham that the public display of the Ten Commandments in Kentucky schools was a violation of the Establishment Clause. There, the court opined that, quote, "The preeminent purpose of posting the Ten Commandments on schoolroom walls is plainly religious in nature. The Ten Commandments are undeniably a sacred text of the Jewish and Christian faiths, and no legislative recitation of a supposed secular purpose can blind us to that fact," close quote. So in sum, finely nuanced and apparently inconsistent power-grabbing legislation is what we've come to expect from the court. Unfortunately, this willy-nilly approach to freedom of religion in the U.S. does not look as if it will reverse itself anytime soon. We were warned about this. Tocqueville warned, quote, "Local liberty is a rare and fragile thing. Among all liberties, that of townships, which is established with such difficulty, is also the most exposed to the invasions of power," close quote. Regarding religion, I believe local standards should prevail, as they did, by and large, until the federal judiciary stepped in and one order at a time ordered the states to stop what they were doing in the realm of religion. The following will be an examination of how they did it, how the United States Supreme Court and the lower courts that are bound to follow them did it, with some suggestions on how to remedy the problem. Here is where it starts. Federalism, states' rights, and dual sovereignty. Remember that in America we have a system of dual sovereignty. We have a state, and remember, a state is a plenary power empowered organization of people. That means a state is like we think of as the state of France or the state of Great Britain or the state of Hungary. It is an independent sovereign nation. That's what the word state means. So they have full power to decide those issues about government for the people, unless they have given up some of that full power to another body. So as I'll show you in this section, this will show you that the states have plenary power, And what was given to the United States government are what are called enumerated or limited powers. And what I'm going to show you is that what was never given to the United States government was the ability to decide questions of religion for the people. And here, as I say, the balance of power in federalism, juridically speaking, issue spotting what went wrong regarding establishment and free exercise of religion is just not that difficult. It's an elementary exercise in the study of constitutional law. The problem here is easy to spot. Is our nation a lex rex, the law is king, or a rex lex issue, where the king is the law? I mean, that's always the issue in talking about these things. Is the king subject to the law itself, or does the king make the law? Israel, in its Old Testament form, is called a theocracy, and it was. But it was also a constitutional monarchy, if you recall that, because even the king was under the law of God. The king had to obey the law. And, as we tend not to think this way, there was a, quote, separation of church and state in Israel. The kingly line and the kingly functions came from the Davidic line, and where did the religious and priestly functions come from? That's right, from the Levites. So when we look at that, there was a clear separation of powers in Israel. And in seeing those things, the king exercised his functions and the Levites exercised their functions along with the prophets. And when a king tried to intervene in the church, speaking here, now the church wasn't around at that time, we'd still call it Israel, but what happened? When Saul tried to intervene and offer sacrifice, his line was cut off. And we see a couple of other examples in Scripture where kings are cut off when they try and meddle in the religious aspects of the kingdom. Now, so in that case, there's always been, in effect, a separation of powers. But here, what we're looking at is who is king and who decides the law and who has the power to do it. So here, we talk about states. States have plenary power. They have full power to decide a question unless they give it to another entity by treaty, by constitution, so forth. The federal government has enumerated powers granted to it by the states. Enumerated powers are a body of limited, clearly defined powers granted to it by the states. The United States Supreme Court has acknowledged this from the beginning of the nation. One of the most notorious cases ever to be decided by the court explains this relationship. In 1857, in the Dred Scott versus Sanford decision, the court explained its dilemma in deciding the case before it. It opined regarding its own authority, quote, "We have said, from the peculiar character of the government of the United States, for although it is a sovereign and supreme in the appropriate sphere of action, yet it does not possess all the powers which usually belong to the sovereignty of the nation. Certain specified powers enumerated in the Constitution have been conferred upon it, and neither the legislative, executive, nor judicial departments of the government can lawfully exercise any authority beyond the limits marked out by the Constitution. And in regulating the judicial department, the cases in which the courts of the United States shall have jurisdiction are particularly and specifically enumerated and defined, and they are not authorized to take cognizance of any case which has not come within the description therein specified. Hence, when a plaintiff sues in a court of the United States, it is necessary that he should show in his pleading that the suit he brings is within the jurisdiction of the court and that he's entitled to sue there." Now, this goes on, in effect, to explain why Dred Scott can't be given national citizenship, why this slave can't be freed, because we haven't been given the power to do it. In a almost 200-page opinion, they said, "We sympathize with you, but we're not authorized to do it." And that's it. So what you had was a horrible decision, but legally speaking, it was correct because the court didn't have the power to decide it. Morally, could they have stepped in? Yes. But their answer was, I mean, could they have done it? Well, yes, but legally speaking, should they have? Not if they're going to follow the original intent of the Constitution. What they should have said is you need to fix it according to the appropriate legal sphere. Now, in explaining this, the court went on to say, "The people were assured by their most trusted statesmen." This is the Dred Scott court talking about the founders of the U.S. Constitution, why they can't do it. "The people were assured by their most trusted statesmen that the jurisdiction of the federal government is limited to certain enumerated objects, which concerns all members of the republic. and that the local or municipal authorities form distinct portions of supremacy, no more subject within their respective spheres to the general authority than the general authority is subject to them within their own sphere. Still, this did not content them. Under the leadership of Hancock, Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry, and George Mason, they demanded an explicit declaration that no more power was to be exercised than they had delegated. And the 9th and 10th Amendments to the Constitution were designed to include the reserve rights of the states and the people within all the sanctions of that instrument, and to bind the authorities, state and federal, by the judicial oath it prescribed to the recognition and observance. It goes on to say other things, but in effect, it says, we don't have the power to decide the case, and we're not going to usurp the authority of the states and go in. As tragic as this is, you're in the wrong court. And this has continually been the refrain that if a harm is to be remedied, it needs to be remedied by the appropriate body. So here, it goes on to say, what are the Bill of Rights? The first 8 amendments specified the rights of the states. But just in case the specific protections were not clear enough from the first 8 amendments of the Constitution, the 9th and 10th amendments made it so. The 9th amendment states, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. The 10th amendment states, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited to it by the state, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So, the Bill of Rights, as it was originally given, we see this, what was it meant to do? It was meant to clarify that the federal government shall not intrude on the states on these matters. You cannot tell us what to do on religion. You cannot tell us what to do in free speech. You cannot tell us what to do in all these things. That's not your job. And we're making it explicit that this is retained by the people of the states, and you have nothing to say about it. Okay. So, how is this understood? The first major case to be decided on the Bill of Rights, 1833, Barron versus Baltimore. What happened in this case? Summary of the facts. Somebody drained the swamp. In this case, it was the city leaders. Barron had a wharf. People docked their boats there, and because of a number of levees and dikes that were set up, lowered the water. And it's what, so he couldn't use it as a wharf anymore. So he went and sued. He went into federal court and says, you know, the Fifth Amendment says that you can't take property without just compensation. And in short, the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, you're in the wrong court. You know, the Fifth Amendment doesn't apply to the states. None of the Bill of Rights applies to the states. You're in the wrong court. And here's what they said. Chief Justice John Marshall said, in relevant part, the question presented here, we think, is of great importance, but not much difficulty. The Constitution was ordained and established by the people of the United States for themselves and for their own government, not for the government of the individual states. Each state established a constitution for itself, and in that constitution provided such limitations and restrictions on the powers of its particular government as its judgment dictated. The people of the United States framed such a government of the United States that they supposed best adapted to their situation and best calculated to promote their interests. The powers they conferred on this government were to be exercised by itself, and the limitations on power, if expressed in general terms, are naturally, and we think, necessarily applicable to the government created by that instrument. They are limitations of power granted in the instrument itself, not of distinct governments framed by different persons and for different purposes. So after stating that the plaintiff was in the wrong court, what did they further say? They said, quote, and this is important, and every person in America should read this part of Barron versus Baltimore. It said, quote, had the people of the several states or any of them required changes in their constitutions, had they required additional safeguards to liberty from the apprehended encroachments of their particular governments, that is the state governments, the remedy was in their own hands. They would have been applied by themselves. A convention would have been assembled by the discontented state, and the required improvements would have been made by itself. The unwieldy and cumbrous machinery of procuring a recommendation from 2/3 of Congress and assent of 3/4 of their sister states could never have occurred to any human being as a mode of doing that which might be affected by the state itself. had the framers of these amendments intended them to be limitations on the powers of the state governments, they would have imitated the framers of the original Constitution and have expressed that intention. Had Congress engaged in the extraordinary occupation of improving the constitutions of the several states by affording the people additional protection from the exercise of power by their own governments in matters which concern themselves alone, they would have declared this purpose in plain and intelligible language, close quote. And this is exactly the point, because why in the world would you have, you know, a problem with a local sheriff? And the remedy, I mean, to summarize it here, the remedy is this. Let's try and get two-thirds of Congress to agree on a constitutional amendment, pass it, and then get three-quarters of the sister states, you know, to ratify this amendment. How about you just get your local assemblyman, state senator, and governor, and get them to remedy the problem? That's a far easier method to try and fight that battle than to do this. And that's why the Supreme Court said in Barron, what person in their right mind would try and do that when you have a local remedy? And, of course, the issue is they're right. Nobody in their right mind does. Because the Constitution was never amended to fix these problems. But what did you have? You had judges who began to simply say, we're assuming jurisdiction, we're going to decide the question for you. But at this point, what you see here is that the Bill of Rights clearly does not apply to the states. Now I'm going to summarize most of the rest of the paper. But how do we go from essentially states deciding all questions of religion to the point where a sitting Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court can't display the Ten Commandments? Here's how. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. We already talked about the First Amendment, the amendments of the Bill of Rights generally. But here's the point. If one asked an average lawyer or layman what the meaning and the purpose of the First Amendment was, one will probably hear the mantric response, separation of church and state, and not much more. But this is not the First Amendment. To restate it, it says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, close quote. By this, the founders intended only to preclude the establishment of a national denomination. It was never intended to restrain public religious expressions. Thomas Jefferson on the subject. One of the most telling pieces of evidence against the modern understanding of the First Amendment is Thomas Jefferson himself. The author of the famed Wall of Separation language in his now infamous letter to the Danbury Baptist, he had some other things to say about the limits of federal power in the relationship between church and state. And I say this because the 1947 Everson decision quotes Jefferson's letter to a group in 1801, a group called the Danbury Baptist. They were writing the newly elected president and congratulating him, but asking about this First Amendment stuff. And he said, don't worry, you know, Baptists have been historically persecuted, but here there's a wall of separation between church and state. So all the court does in 1947, 200 years after the fact, or 150 years after the fact, is quote Jefferson out of context and introduce this metaphor of a wall of separation. But what did Jefferson actually mean by the wall of separation? Here's a quote by Jefferson, and what he thinks about how the federal government should step in and answer these questions. He says, quote, I consider the government of the United States as interdicted by the Constitution from intermeddling with religious institutions, their doctrines, discipline, or exercises. This results not only from the provision that no law shall be made respecting the establishment or free exercise of religion, but from that also which reserves to the states the powers not delegated to the United States. Certainly no power to prescribe any religious exercise or to assume authority in any religious discipline has been delegated to the federal government. It must then rest with the states, close quote. So Thomas Jefferson himself says all questions about religion rest with the states. Joseph Story. Now, Joseph Story, who's that? Not Joseph Smith, Joseph Story. Who's Joseph Story? He's one of the first United States Supreme Court justices. Died in 1845, the founder of Harvard Law School. He's considered by most the founder of American jurisprudence or law. He wrote in 1833, published it, his Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States. So we have a sitting Supreme Court justice for 40 years, founder of Harvard Law School, part of this original generation. And what does he say? his commentaries on the constitutions regarding the First Amendment. Quote, "The whole power over the subject of religion is left exclusively to the state governments, to be acted upon according to their own sense of justice and the state constitutions," close quote. Story further clarified regarding the First Amendment that, quote, "The real object of the amendment was not to countenance, much less advance, Mohammedanism," that is Islam, "or Judaism or infidelity by prostrating Christianity, but to exclude all rivalry among Christian sectarian groups," close quote. So it's clear. What's the purpose of the First Amendment? Exclude rivalry among Christian groups. And it's solely a question for the state governments to decide what that means. So how did the state governments exercise their retained authority over religious matters? Well, this is easy to spot. Just look at what they've been doing for 150 years before the Supreme Court started declaring these things unconstitutional. They didn't seem to understand separation of church and state the way the modern U.S. Supreme Court understood it. But here's what took place. Besides looking at that for 150 years, we can look at the original constitutions of the several states to see what provisions they made for religion. And while the states could have established a state denomination, they did not. Okay. What did they do? Mostly they made provisions for general public teaching and encouragement of religion. For example, and I'm quoting here the Massachusetts State's Constitution in 1780, and here's what it says. Quote, "As the happiness of a people and the good order and preservation of civil government essentially depend upon piety, religion, and morality, and as these cannot be generally diffused through a community, but by the institution of the public worship of God and of public instruction in piety, religion, and morality, therefore to promote their happiness and to secure the good order and preservation of their government, the people of this commonwealth have a right to invest their legislature with the power to authorize and require the several towns, parishes, precincts, and other bodies politic or religious societies to make suitable provision at their own expense for the institution of the public worship of God and for the support and maintenance of public Protestant teachers of piety, religion, and morality," close quote. This is a state constitution. New Hampshire was worded almost the same, but they added these words, quote, "Morality and piety are grounded in evangelical principles," close quote. So from these state constitutional provisions, the actual practice of the states for nearly two centuries and the unanimous voice of the founders and the early justices of the United States Supreme Court, they said they have the right to determine, the states do, the extent of the relationship between church and state. It rests solely with the people of the several states. The feds have no say in the matter. So how did we get to the point where we've got the constitutions of the states saying we must, for good order and our posterity and liberty, have public instruction and piety and religion, to the U.S. Supreme Court today saying you can't even display the Ten Commandments. Somebody might be offended. Enter the doctrine of the selective incorporation of the Bill of Rights and the substantive due process of the 14th Amendment. Here's what it means. It's interesting that a modern justice, Justice Kennedy, says this. He says the First Amendment, unfortunately, Justice Kennedy says that the United States Supreme Court, because of its micromanagement of religion, has become, quote, a national theology board. And that's exactly right. They're simply deciding minutiae questions regarding church and state. But the question here is, how did the original vision of the founders and the states morph into the current system where an unelected federal judicial panel of 5 out of 9 can, by ex nihilo fiat, create new fundamental rights and national policy? The answer is the juridical theory of substantive due process and selective incorporation. Okay. Now, as a summary here, remember, if we want to add national permanent rights, there's a way to do that. And that was mentioned in Barron versus Baltimore. Just get 2/3 of the Congress to recommend it and 3/4 of the states to ratify it. You can nationalize this. But you know what? The states haven't given the federal government that power. Instead, we go back to judges having invented a theory called substantive due process and selective incorporation. And what is it? It has to do with interpreting one line in the 14th Amendment. And here's what it is. 14th Amendment, substantive due process, and selective incorporation. Anyone who's taken a course in law school or a bar review course has confronted the phraseology necessary to remember and recite in order to obtain a passing grade on any essay dealing with a Bill of Rights question. That phrase is, quote, "The First Amendment Establishment Clause made applicable to the states by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment," close quote. When the selective incorporation doctrine is discussed in law schools, it's usually in a discourse regarding the extent, how, and when it was accomplished, not whether it was actually permissible. Now, what is the 14th Amendment? The 14th Amendment was the second of three Civil War amendments. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery in 1865. When certain states refused to treat the freed slaves as equal citizens by the states in which they resided, the 14th Amendment was passed in 1868 to ensure that the freed slaves enjoyed the same rights as all the other citizens of the states. Okay. Then the 15th Amendment was passed in 1870 to guarantee the right to vote for the freed slaves. So there are three constitutional amendments from 1865 to 1870 that all had to do specifically with making sure that the freed slave enjoyed the rights of citizenship of all other citizens. That's the purpose of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Now, the 14th Amendment, Privileges and Immunities, Due Process, and Equal Protection Clause, is the focus of the federal judiciary. And by the way, so that you know what's the relevance of this, what's going on right now in the Senate? Whether or not we can get our judicial nominees confirmed, right? I mean, that's the big focus today by, you know, political conservatives and others, because if we just get judges who are conservative, see, then they can use this mechanism, or we can use the Supreme Court to shift back certain kinds of ideas in our land. And the problem is that, well, that is one strategy that we need to think about, but that's like saying, what's the best way to score a touchdown when playing football? When a question should be along with it is whether or not we should play football in the first place. You know, and all we're doing is trying to figure out the best way to score a touchdown while playing football. And again, this is not particular to football. That's just that you can understand the illustration. We're talking about what's the best way, given substantive due process and selective incorporation, to get the justices to beg and plead that we can get five of them to actually, you know, agree with the Constitution at some point. Instead, we should be saying, you know what, you guys have usurped the authority of the Constitution and the states, and we're simply going to throw you out of office and ignore you. Instead of saying that, you know, the remedy here is to get the right justices. No, the remedy is for the Congress to take its authority back, instead of giving authority in the final say to the U.S. Supreme Court. But in going through this paper, this is not just First Amendment issues. Lawrence v. Texas, now there's a fundamental right to sodomy. Where'd that come from? Substantive due process. Where did the right to abortion come from? Substantive due process and selective incorporation of the Bill of Rights of the states. 90% of the problems that we have with the federal government come from this judicial theory that was forced upon the states about 80 years ago. So this isn't just religious freedom. This is, you know, the fundamental right to sodomy now. Last week, the Massachusetts State Supreme Court said there's a right to homosexual marriage. So now we're going to have to be dealing with a full faith and credit clause provision. Are we going to have to recognize homosexual marriages that are performed in other states? So this isn't just whether or not we can display the Ten Commandments, although that's the focus of this paper. This is everything. This is sodomy. This is about what five people want to grant or deny. That's why I said this is a justiciarchy that has formed. It is really this, and this has to be dealt with if we're going to live free in our culture in as Christians, having representative government. So that to continue with this is why people have to understand this. This is what's going on and what the problem is. Back to the paper, the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause, Due Process, Equal Protection Clause says this, quote, remember, this is 1868, "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deny any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of laws." Now, what does that mean? Pretty clearly it means privileges and immunities. If you're a citizen of the state, this is the federal privileges and immunities clause, it means that whatever the state grants it has to treat all citizens equally. If there's a privilege, it grants to all equally. If it's an immunity, it grants to all equally. Okay? That's all it means. There's a federal clause. There's a state clause on privileges and immunities. Substantive due process. No state can deny anyone life, liberty, or property without due process of law. In other words, you can't just come in and take someone's property or life without a procedure. You have to have a hearing, notice, a trial. They have to go through the right governmental process. Okay? And then the Equal Protection Clause. Everyone's treated equally under law. That's all it says. Now, in this case, after the 14th Amendment was passed, what does it mean? Pretty clearly, just what I stated. In fact, there's an 1873 case that's called the Slaughterhouse Cases. After this, what do you have? A group of state of Louisiana in early 1870s saw a huge cattle surplus in Texas, and for whatever reasons, they granted a monopoly to one slaughterhouse. And the other people said, the other slaughterhouse said, I'm out of a job. I can't make a living. So they went to the federal courts and said, you know, the 14th Amendment says, no state can deny a person life, liberty, or property without due process of law. They're denying me my property. And what did the court say? You're in the wrong court. This has nothing to do with the federal government. It says that, look, your remedy is with your state court. All this did was ensure that the slaves were freed and entitled to the same protection as everyone else in the state. So the first decision interpreting the 14th Amendment said that. But, of course, federal courts being what they are, here you begin to have a shift in constitutional jurisprudence and philosophy of language, and that's for another time and place. But here's where the beginnings of, to make it clear, making it up as you go exegesis begins. Instead of actually interpreting the document, we're going to do judicial construction. In other words, we're going to try and find a way to insert what we want into the meaning of the Constitution. So that by the end of the century, what you saw is you had a set of justices who wanted to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. They simply wanted to do it. Now, they tried, they couldn't do it through the Privileges and Immunities Clause or the Due Process Clause, and because that was rejected in 1873. So they gave up on the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And then they went to the Due Process Clause. No state shall deny any person life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And then somebody, somewhere at some time, got the bright idea, hey, that word liberty, that's a noun. That's got meaning to it. We can decide what liberty is. Surely the liberties are at least the ones guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. And what is the nature of ordered liberty? And what they began to do is say, apply or selectively incorporate or apply the Bill of Rights to the states, the guarantees in the Bill of Rights. Now think about the logic of this. From the beginning of the Bill of Rights to this time, you have all of the founders, all of the writers, Jefferson himself, all the court case saying, the Bill of Rights applies to the states. These are rights that the states retain. How can the federal government apply these rights to the states if they were never federal rights to begin with? But see, this is turning everything on its head. Aha, well see, these are the rights that are guaranteed. So now what do we have? Substantive due process. What is the nature of ordered liberty? And what do you need? 5 out of 9 that decide what the word liberty means. And progressively, we saw the selective incorporation of the Bill of Rights. The First Amendment applies to the states. The Third Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment. But particularly what we're concerned with here is the First Amendment and religion. And they started applying it, and what happened? Beginning in 1947 with Everson versus Board of Education, they said, wait a minute, you states, you can't give aid to public schools or to private religious schools. Why not? Because that's the wall of separation. You can't do that. And just look at the list of decisions that have flowed since 1947 and the Everson case. No prayer in school, even if it's voluntary. Cannot display the Ten Commandments. No aid to religious schools. No teaching of creation. No war memorials in the shape of a cross. Public cemeteries cannot have a planter in the shape of a cross. It might cause emotional distress. A board of education may not use the word God in any of its official writings. city seals with religious symbols are unacceptable. Artwork with religious symbols cannot be displayed in public schools. A kindergarten class may not ask whose birthday is celebrated at Christmas. No school prayers at public school graduation or ceremonies. Nativity scenes may be displayed only if there are sufficient secular displays around it to prevent it from appearing religious. Murder cases were overturned where an attorney cited 7 words from the Bible in a courtroom. Alaska public school students were prohibited from using the word Christmas at school or exchanging Christmas cards because they contained the word Christ. And of course, one more, a sitting chief justice of a state court cannot display the Ten Commandments in the rotunda of his own court, even though they're displayed in the U.S. Supreme Court building. Why should selective incorporation be rejected? Besides the fact that there was never an explicit constitutional amendment that was ever made, and this is purely a judicial invention, people need to take note of this, and that is the Blaine Amendment, which was attempted in 1875. What did the Blaine Amendment say? The Blaine Amendment was clear. The Blaine Amendment said, quote, "No state shall make any law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof," close quote. There were some additional things to that, but the point is that this is 1875. The 14th Amendment was passed in 1868. 7 years later, they tried to pass a constitutional amendment which applied the First Amendment to the states. They tried to say that the Congress now can decide religion questions, and that was rejected. So the question is, if the Bill of Rights were applied to the states, supposedly, in 1868, why would they attempt to pass a constitutional amendment 7 years later to incorporate it? The answer is because they didn't think the Bill of Rights applied to the states, and it was rejected. So what we have now, as a result, are 50 years since 1947, approximately, of the U.S. Supreme Court telling you, telling local communities, telling us what we can and can't do regarding religion. And it's gone from not being able to quote the Bible in public school to now we've got to recognize as a country the fundamental right of sodomy. The issue here is when will it stop? And the issue is it won't stop. Historically, if you look at the history of the church, when Christians failed to get involved in these things, what happens? We allow these judicial theories to go on. Look at what happened in the Middle East. That was the bastion of Christendom. And because of apathy, liberalism, what you had was a weak church, and you had Islam take over most of the Middle East. There are very few Christians left in the Middle East. What did you have in Russia? You had originally a very robust Russian Orthodox Church, became weak, was taken over by the communists. What did you have in Germany? The foundational bedrock of Protestantism, eventually weakened by liberalism and taken over by the Nazis. And where are we at? Where we began? We can't kick out people in the Evangelical Theological Society who deny inerrancy. These are supposed to be the scholars and the leaders of evangelicalism. And we're sitting here begging and pleading the United States Supreme Court to please let us teach creation in our own public schools. This is why, and I say this, we do not do something soon, because it's accelerating now. As you know, the curve is accelerating. Our rights will continually be curbed and curbed and curbed, and we are getting to the point of persecution. Now our persecution is people don't like us. But what's on the horizon now? Hate speech laws. They're already in Canada. They're already in France. A couple of weeks ago, an Anglican priest was almost brought up on hate speech charges because he suggested in a sermon that homosexuals could get help for their problem and go get counseling and change their orientation. With the United States Supreme Court, with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and others saying in their own speeches and their own opinions now, that they are looking to the laws of the other lands. They're looking to France, to Canada, to try and help them understand where we should be in our constitutional exegesis, because it's a living, breathing document. Read into that, we're making it up as we go, and we're going to grant rights to whom we want to grant rights and deny rights to whom we want to deny rights. That's where we're at. And the only way we're going to stop this is for you to get informed on these things, for you to get active in these things, and, as Christians, to serve Christ in whatever capacity you can, in your appropriate capacity, to do a Romans 13 ministry. There is a civil use of the law, and it's to restrain evil and to protect the church until Christ comes back, so that we can fulfill the Great Commission. Government will never save anybody. It's not designed to do that. And people who try and put gospel into government are making a huge error, because you can never force people to believe. But government is supposed to restrain evil and protect the church. And when that's done right, what do we see? And when we have good theology, we're passionate for Christ, and we have freedom, there's just no limit to what we can do. If God is for us, who can be against us? So with that, there's much more to say, but that is the end of the topic for today. So let's close in a word of prayer, and then we'll dismiss. Father, I thank you so much for your goodness, for your loving kindness, for your graciousness. I thank you for my brothers and sisters and your great love. Father, I pray for our nation. I pray that you would raise up godly leaders who understand your word, who understand the law. And I pray you would raise them up, that there would be righteousness and justice and truth that would be in our land. God, I pray for revival and reformation in our churches. God, that we would not tolerate the heresy and the evil that we do. God, we are responsible to you for the knowledge that we have. Today, renew us with a new filling of your Holy Spirit. God, help us to repent of our sins, our apathy, and send us out with boldness and with just a love for people and a love for you, that we might fulfill your word and your commission. So God, thank you for the privilege of being able to come before you. And we just pray this in the name of your precious Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.